Cześć wszystkim, słuchacie podcastu o języku. Ja się nazywam Marysia i dziś chciałam wprowadzić Was w świat wielojęzyczności. Co sprawia, że przełączając się między językami, stajemy się inną wersją siebie? Jak to możliwe, że w jednym języku potrafimy zepchnąć kogoś z mostu, a w drugim nie? W jaki sposób znajomość języków obcych wpływa na zdrowie naszego mózgu? O tym wszystkim porozmawiamy z profesor Wioriką Marian, która pracuje w Northwestern University w Chicago. Profesor Marian od ponad 30 lat bada wielojęzyczność i jej wpływ na ludzki umysł, odkryła różne ciekawe zależności między znajomością wielu języków a sposobem, w jaki myślimy, podejmujemy decyzje, a nawet o tym, jak długo nasz mózg pozostaje zdrowy. Rozmawiamy o jej bestsellerowej książce Potęga języka, która właśnie ukazała się w polskim tłumaczeniu w wydawnictwie Uniwersytetu Jagiellońskiego. Rozmowa jest w języku angielskim, ale jeśli chcecie przeczytać ją po polsku, to możecie zajrzeć na naszą stronę ojęzyku.pl, bo cały transkrypt z tej rozmowy został tam zamieszczony i przetłumaczony właśnie na język polski. A jeśli czujecie się okej z językiem angielskim, to zapraszam Was serdecznie do słuchania na Spotify i innych platformach streamingowych, albo do oglądania na YouTubie. Zaczynamy rozmowę. Hello, as I've introduced before, we have a special guest today, Professor Wiorika Marian from the Northwestern University, who has written a very interesting book about multilingualism and the power of language. That's actually the title in English, The Power of Language. And today we'll be speaking about the book, The Magic of Multilingualism, and the ways in which language shapes our thoughts and our reality. So can I ask you first, what was the motive behind the book? And why did you decide to name it The Power of Language?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you, Maria. And it's a pleasure to have this podcast to reach to the Polish listeners and the bilinguals and multilinguals in Poland. The Polish edition of the book is coming out next week. And this is my first Polish interview with a Polish listeners. I have an interview next week with Gazeta Wyborcza. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, and more coming, and I'm really looking forward to these conversations. I've been to Poland once in the past and really enjoyed it. What a wonderful country. I had a wonderful visit. I was in Krakow, which is such a beautiful city, and loved the people I met, the food, the culture, everything was just wonderful. So thank you. Just so thrilled. And staying with the Polish theme, I do live in Chicago now, which happens to have quite a large population of Polish immigrants. I think it's the largest outside Poland. So we even have, you know, entire neighborhoods that are entirely Polish and restaurants and communities where Polish is spoken. Just not too far from my house here, there is a Polish house with a Polish flag, Polish and American flags next to each other. So I'm just thrilled to have this opportunity to connect with readers in Poland. Now, back to your question, how did this come to be? So I am multilingual myself. I was born, even though I've lived in the States for most of my life, I was born as a child, spent time in Moldova, which you being Polish know where Moldova is in the States. Most people have never heard of it. But I was born in Moldova when it was still when it was still part of USSR, and left Moldova when it was still part of USSR before it became an independent country. So at the time, even though I'm ethnically Romanian and we spoke Romanian at home, Russian was the official language in public spaces. So we had to speak Russian, and I grew up with both Romanian and Russian in parallel in the way where I, you know, speak both fluently, don't have an accent in either. And then in school started to learn English, where now English is my third and fluent language. Then in college, I learned French, and then studied Spanish. And along the line, along the way in life, picked up multiple other languages. So part of this interest is really rooted in my own personal background of growing up with multiple languages, and often noticing really peculiar differences or interesting things about the languages I knew and how they differed and how they sort of changed a little bit the way I thought about things. And we can go into examples later if you want, but I think every person who grew up or who speaks two or more languages to fluency notices differences between languages. And sometimes those differences can be puzzling. And then when I became an academic and went into science and research, Initially, as an experimental psychologist, interested in language. So a psycholinguist, my area of expertise is psycholinguistics, the psychology of language, which is a field at the intersection of psychology and linguistics. I noticed that at the time, and we are talking early 90s, there was very little research on bilinguals and multilinguals. Most research was really on just monolingual speakers, usually English, sometimes some of the other Northern or Western European languages, but really having this very monolingual model. And I remember even, you know, as a young person walking through bookstores and libraries and looking for books that were about language, and all of them really had the perspective of one language. Philosophy, whether you're talking about philosophy of language, linguistics, experimental psychology, it was all monolingualism, which, if you think about it, and I did think about it, did not reflect the reality of the world out there. Most of the world is not monolingual. The majority of the world population grows up with two or more languages or acquires two or more languages in school or later in life. So it's very common in countries all over the world for people to grow up with two or more languages. So if we only look at monolinguals and try to understand language and try to understand the mind, we leave out this huge segment of the world population. And we really get an incomplete and really an inaccurate understanding of the mind, of humanity's potential, of the brain, just, you know, what it means to be human and our capacity as a species. It's like it's leaving this huge piece of the puzzle out of the equation. And, you know, I tend to say that this is similar to the field of medicine, where heart disease and diabetes was studied extensively, usually in either just white people or in just men. And we know that heart disease shows up differently in women. And we know that diabetes shows up differently in individuals that are indigenous to North and South America. So if we only study heart disease in one population or diabetes in one population, we don't full a full understanding of the etiology of the disease. We really don't have a full understanding of what heart disease is, how to treat it, how it like none of that. So we really do need to have to understand how language works, to understand how mind works, we need to look at people who speak multiple languages, minds that can accommodate multiple languages simultaneously. The way the mind works when it just processes one language versus in people who know two, three, four, seven, you know, multiple languages is different. So it's a long-winded answer to your question, which sort of seems very simple, but it taps into my personal background, historical sort of cultural forces, and the state of science that brought us to where we are now, where there are so many people around the world and labs and researchers who are doing really good work on bilingualism and multilingualism.
I will start with establishing a common middle ground, because you have said many things that are for the researcher, this is a standard to say this is a bilingual, this is a monolingual. But I think for the people who actually speak several languages, for example, in Poland, everyone knows at least English or Russian and Polish and several other languages, people would be very humble. If you ask them, are you monolingual? They would say, no, I'm a native Polish speaker. So I wanted to ask you about the scientific definition and how it may differ from our common perception of who a bilingual is or monolingual, and what does it mean to be a bilingual?
Yeah, that is such an excellent question. You're right on the money to say the definitions of bilingualism differ. And yes, they differ across studies and researchers, but they also differ across individuals. And we see it across cultures, across groups of people, where you might have one person who says, yes, I'm bilingual, I'm fluent in Spanish, where all they can say is, you know, hola and una cerveza, por favor, and, you know, very, very basic rudimentary Spanish. And then you have people who can read and write and have an understanding of grammar in another language, but when you ask them, they'll be very humble and they say, yes, I speak it a little bit and I know it a little bit. And that's definitely the case. So my two ways to answer this question, I don't know if you want me to approach it from the point of view of how research is done or what the definition is, and how do we think of bilingualism. But in research, the people use it not always consistently, and that in fact is what explains oftentimes differences between findings, why some people find set one set of results and other labs find different sets of results. Sometimes it's because they use different populations of bilinguals, different level of fluency, different languages, different ages of acquisition. All of those things matter. And so who is a bilingual really depends on the purposes and the goals of what you're bilingual for. What is the final goal there? So in our research in the lab, we usually do both subjective self-reports with questionnaires, but also objective measures of proficiency, maybe vocabulary, maybe grammar, depending on the language and on the study that we are running. But in the real world, whether or not you're bilingual largely depends on whether it meets your functional needs. Do you know the language to the level you need in order to be able to function it, either to communicate in it or to study in it or to work in it? So those definitions vary. And that's true for every other sort of ability that humans may have. Like, what does it mean to be fit? What does it mean to be athletic or sporty? Some people walk 20 minutes a day and say, yeah, I'm so fit and sporty. And others are professional athletes and say, well, I'm not that great. There are people better than me. So definitions vary, but I would say if you can communicate in two languages in a way that meets your needs, then you are and you have you meet some basic standards of fluency with tests. And most languages have, like, for example, to study in a certain language or to immigrate to a country or to work in a certain language, you have to test to a certain level. Then you're considered bilingual.
And I wanted to ask a follow-up question here, because in Poland, often people think that a bilingual is a person who was born into two languages. For example, a mother speaking Polish, father speaking English. And once you hit a milestone, you cannot be called a bilingual. So told that age can be a factor, but how is it regarded also by the modern science? If we learn English when we are like 7 or 10 at school, can we still call ourselves bilinguals?
Yes, we can. And there are distinctions between early bilinguals, people who grew up with two languages, and then late bilinguals, people who learn a second language later in life. But you can learn a second language and you can learn it to fluency later in life as well. And you can actually see some of the changes to the brain, to the way your cognition functions. Even if you learn a second language quite late in life. So it is possible to learn a language at any age. You may learn it differently and you may have other challenges. So, for example, one of the things that often happens is when you learn a second language post puberty, you will end up keeping an accent most of the time. Like you and I are both now communicating in English. It's not the first language for either of us. So, we both have an accent, most likely because we didn't grow up with this language from early childhood. But that's all right. Having an accent is not an impediment to being able to understand and produce language spoken and both and written fluently. So, yes, there are differences, and the earlier you start studying a language, the better. And my take on this is the best time to learn another language is from birth. And then the second best time is now. So it's never too late. It doesn't matter how old you are. You can always start learning a second language. You can be as fluent as, depending on how much effort and time you put into it. And you can start seeing some of the benefits.
You mentioned that the brain actually can change and adapt when you learn a new language. I know it will be a very broad question for the starters. In your book, also, we can read about many, many ways in which learning a new language can change our brain or shape some parts of our brain. But could you enumerate, like, if the most important or prominent things for you that are affected in our brains, in our cognition, when we learn a new language?
Sure. So the book is organized into two parts, where the first part looks at how knowing two or more languages changes the individual, changes the self, the brain, emotions, relationships, identity, all of that. And then the second part looks at how bilingualism and multilingualism changes societies and, you know, in a broader sort of frame. So if we look at the brain specifically, you can think of bilingualism and multilingualism as constant exercise for the brain, keeping your brain active, keeping your brain engaged, just like your body. You know, you have to go out, keep it fit, move it, exercise it. What happens when you know two or more languages? You constantly have to control the two languages. So like right now, as we are speaking in English, we have to make sure that we prioritize English, we facilitate English, and we inhibit all of the other languages we know. If it's Polish, if it's Russian, if it's whatever other language you know, we have to make sure that it doesn't suddenly pop out. Like if you will now start speaking to me in Polish, it won't be, I'll understand some of it, but it won't be as smooth of a communicative exchange here. So we have to constantly inhibit the irrelevant language and facilitate the relevant language. And this, it's like giving the green light to one language and then the red light to the other language. And you have to do that constantly. We know based on lots of research, and I of course talk about that in the lab as well, eye tracking, in the book as well, eye tracking research, brain imaging research, that our languages are constantly activated in our brain. They constantly interact. They constantly mutually influence each other. And you can see influences from one language into another. And this need to manage this coactivation and competition results in this neural activity that improves cognitive control, this ability to control languages, executive function. Multiple areas of the brain are being actively used when you have to constantly juggle more than one language. You can think, so, you know, when individuals get older, for example, we are often encouraging older adults to keep their brains active by doing word puzzles, Sudoku puzzles, you know, keeping your brain actively and working it out often. But what's interesting, when you do that, you actually have to take time out of your life to exercise your brain. You have to sit down and actively, you know, do some puzzles. Whereas when you know two or more languages, you do that all the time. You just go about your life, you talk to one person, you talk to another person, you watch a movie, you listen to a song, and you're constantly juggling multiple languages. So the workout is constant. And there is now evidence that the brains of bilinguals and multilinguals remain healthy longer later in life, where if you are going to develop Alzheimer's or other types of dementia, you are diagnosed 4 to 6 years later, depending on the study or the population, than if you are monolingual and only speak one language. So this exercise that the brain gets by juggling multiple languages allows you to compensate functionally for the anatomical neural deterioration that sometimes happens with dementia, for example. So the one way to think about it is, imagine if you take a certain road home every day. You go to work, you come back, you take that road. You go to the grocery store, you come back, you take the same road. You go to the pharmacy, you know, whatever you do, you take the same road every day. And then one day on the way home, you discover that that road has collapsed. If you have access to other roads, if there is, you know, an infrastructure that has been built and there are other roads or bridges around, you just sort of change the navigation and change your route and reach your home with no problem. But if that is the only road you have to reach your home, then you're out of luck. You will not be able to get home anytime soon. In the same way, when you have used two or more languages over the course of your life, you have built memories, experiences, connections between different brain areas that have been spread across two or more languages. And when one of them is impacted by brain disease, you can not really reroute, but you can compensate functionally by drawing on all the other connections and all the other memories and experiences that you have accumulated while using the other two languages. So there are all this lifelong changes to how our brain functions when we are constantly juggling two or more languages.
This is actually an amazing metaphor to explain it with the roots. And also in your book, we can find many such really complex things explained in a really approachable way. Thank you very much for this. And I have more and more questions because once you go through the other layers, I think of more and more questions. So I will go back to the beginning. You said, beside the health benefits, that actually languages that we when we learn them, they can impact our identity or ourselves. So in what ways could the language impact our thoughts, our identity in the even more social, maybe sense as well?
Thank you for saying that the book is written in this accessible way. That was a big goal for me because, for the past 30 years, I've been running experiments, going to conference, giving talks to scientists, and then you have these research papers that are read by such a small group of people. So when I set out to write this book during COVID, and I had, the time, we were all locked in, I really wanted to make sure that I make this concepts accessible, and I bring the science and the research and the state of knowledge to a broader audience. So people can see how their own experiences relate to the scientific data. Because now, like you're asking about identity and sort of self, and I think many of us who know two languages or who live our life sometimes divided across two languages, have this feeling that the language we speak kind of changes who we are and how we feel and how it feels to say I love you in your native language versus in another language. Or, I personally cannot curse in my native language, but can in my third language. And people have these experiences and don't know if it's just them or if there is some truth to it. And then when you really look at the science out there, you can see that, some of your intuitions or personal experiences are reflected in the data. Maybe not all, but in some way, it is in fact true that when you use a language, that language comes with a set of cultural norms, sort of rules and cultural expectations that differ. And as you use one language, that set comes up more, your set of reference, your frame of reference. And you do tend to make different decisions sometimes when you use one language versus another. And there is actually, since this is a Polish interview, there is this Polish English bilingual writer who has a book called, I think it's called Lost in Translation, where she talks about how her desire to whether she should marry a person or whether she should study piano, her decision is influenced by whether she's speaking Polish or English. Where in Polish, she thinks, yes, I should study piano, and I can't remember which way the marriage goes, but in English, it seems she decision was like, well, this is not as practical, so I shouldn't. And I actually had a student in my class who also was saying that he was trying to decide whether to marry a person. And he was saying when he was making the decision in Korean, he was thinking, yes, he should marry his girlfriend. But when he was making the decision in English, he was thinking he shouldn't. And in fact, if you look at study after study, very often bilinguals make different decisions depending upon which language they speak. And these decisions vary in terms of even like medical decision making, financial decision making, interpersonal relationships, to the point of what some of the most interesting line of research comes from a lab at the University of Chicago that looks at I don't know if you're familiar with the trolley dilemma, which is a problem often used to study morality in decision making. There are many versions of that problem, but in this particular version that has been studied with bilinguals, the scenario is that a trolley is coming down the tracks and there are five workers working on the tracks. And this trolley is about to run over these five people. And you're standing on a footbridge next to someone, a big person with a big backpack. If you push that person down, the person would die, but that will stop the trolley and save the lives of these five people. So then the question is that would you push this person off the bridge to sacrifice the life of one to save five? And bilinguals answer somewhat differently if they are asked in their native language or second language. They are much less likely to say that they would push the person when they are answering in the native language, and they are more likely to say that they will push the person when they're answering in the second language. And the difference is in the double digit of percentage points, which is quite a large difference. If you think that the only thing you're changing is the language in which you are asking. The idea being that when you are asking this question in the second language, you're able to make a more logical decision and think about utilitarian greater good approach. What benefits the greater number of people? So sacrificing the life of one to save five. Versus in the native language, you're more guided by emotions and by these deontological values of what's right or wrong, the thou shall not kill sort of mantra. And people vary if you do this. Like I typically do this in my classes when I teach, or even when I give talks, I ask, how many people would push a person to their death to save five? And not as many people say yes. But then you can manipulate that question by saying, what about if you don't have to push the person? All you have to do is press a button. And that changes the answer. And then what about if it's not five people, but 500? What if it's 5 million? So these answers can change depending on how you ask the question. But one variable that makes a difference is the language that we're using, native versus second language. So, oftentimes if you are struggling to make a decision about something, it can't hurt, and it can only help to approach that decision making from two different languages. You may be like, immerse yourself in one language only, listen to songs in that language, think about things in that language, ask yourself in that language, and then later on you switch and you try the same question in the other language, to almost sort of tap into a different version of your identity to help you ultimately arrive to what's the best decision for you. But these are just some of the examples. In the book, I talk a lot more about memory, how things that we remember about our childhood, about our lives in general, how we think about ourselves. Differs depending on the languages we speak. People even score on personality tests differently depending on the language in which those tests are being taken. And since the book has been published, we've been running new studies that eventually, in a few years when they all run, I'll talk about. But now we're looking in things like mental health, depression, anxiety, suicidality, post-traumatic stress disorder in bilinguals in the native versus second language, and finding differences there as well, including an assessment. So, language is such a powerful tool that we are often not even aware of what a difference it can make in our lives if we become more attuned to and aware of the power that the many languages we know have on who we are and how we think. For me personally, 100% I can see differences in how I interact with people, family, friends, coworkers, depending on the language I speak. And even, like what aspects of my identity come forward when I speak one language versus another.
Yeah, and that's actually what I wanted to ask you about because I wanted to share my experience. I'm a native Polish speaker, and then I learned English, French, and several languages. And I was teaching English in COVID and post-COVID online. And when my partner saw me teaching English, he told me I'm a different person. So in Polish, I would be like shy or more, maybe less outgoing. And when I teach English, when I speak English, I'm like super energetic. I'm super confident suddenly. So that's really interesting because I thought that I'm not so confident in English. It's not my native language. But it turns out some parts of my personality behave differently when I speak English. So actually, that's really amazing that you shared. You also have it. But do you have any specific examples, for example, when you speak English versus your native language? What is the main difference? Like, I feel more confident. How about you?
That's such a wonderful example, a really, really good example, because I think it just beautifully illustrates how the cultural background you speak, you of the languages you speak, and sort of the gender roles and then like the social norms, what's more or less appropriate, is reflected in who you are when you speak those languages. And I think my experience aligns with yours as well. When I speak my native language, coming from Southeastern Europe, where gender roles are much more defined, I do become a different version of myself. And when I speak English, so when I think of myself in my native language, I inhabit more of those like family home roles, daughter, sister, family member, because that's the space in which I tend to use that language more. Whereas when I speak English, I tend to tap into a more professional identity because that's why I did all my schooling. That's the language I use at work. So I even say in the book that I would not have been able to write that book in any other language except English. Not only because I don't have the vocabulary for it, but because of all these other things that you were mentioning, that you're bringing up. Sure, my many identities interact and they cross and I can tap into it, but the natural, aspects of me, whether I should be sort of more agreeable and more reserved versus more confident and outspoken, they are tied to the languages we speak, for better or worse.
So I think most people can, if not have observed already. So I would encourage our listeners to think about the roles they switch when they switch languages. But since we talked a little bit about the differences connected to gender in language, I will introduce you to a topic in Poland. It's a really hot topic when it comes to gendered nouns for the female jobs. So, for example, when you're a really important person, like a manager of a company, some people would use the masculine gender noun for the job title, and they would argue that this is the appropriate for the role. But more and more women are using the feminine one, actually. So it's counterintuitive to some languages like English when we try not to use gendered language, especially at workplace. And there is this huge debate connected to this. Does the choice of the words or the language in general shape the reality? Some people say, yes, if I call myself a female manager, it actually shows that I am powerful female who is not afraid to use a female noun to be a manager. So actually the other way around, once again, than in English. And some people say it doesn't matter. You can be use masculine, you can use feminine, because language doesn't really change or shape or have any impact on reality. So what are your thoughts? Because I know you touch a little bit on this topic, on the language versus reality relationship. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I do talk about language and reality, and what is reality and how language shapes reality, and how we think we live in this objective world, but our language shapes how we perceive reality. And I talk about other things, of course, color and concepts in broader forms. But I do talk about gender as well. And gender is such a politicized topic, especially right now. You just have this war, almost seeming war, when you go on social media, that's unfortunate because things are becoming politicized that should not be and don't need to be politicized. So the way I approach this topic is not from that point of view, but really from the point of view of grammatical gender. And in the US, that's a little bit of a foreign concept because English does not have grammatical gender. Polish does. So your listeners, if they speak Polish, they will know what I am referring to. But if for some reason a non-Polish speaker stumbles on this interview and listens to it and doesn't speak a language that has a gendered language, grammatical gender, let me explain what that means. So in English, all nouns are referred to as it. They have no gender, they're gender neuter, it's always it. Whereas many other languages around the world, including Polish and other Slavic languages, including Romance languages and many languages, have grammatical gender. What that means is the objects, even when they're inanimate, they are either a he or a she.
I think for English speakers, if I may, actor and actress would be a good
That's for
example.
profession, yes, for animate professions, but not for inanimate objects like, pen or pencil or glasses or computer or microphone. So that's where a lot of the research has focused. So I think for English speakers or for speakers of languages that don't have grammatical gender, it's almost like a crazy idea to like, why is a pen a feminine gender? Is it feminine in Polish?
No, it's masculine actually.
Okay, in Russian, a pen, ruchka, is feminine. And then if you have a pencil, I don't have a pencil here right now. A pencil in Russian is masculine. What is it in Polish?
It's masculine, yeah, as well.
Yeah. So, when you speak a non-gendered language, non-grammatical gendered language, it's very hard to learn that and to understand why is this feminine, why is the other one masculine, or like why is like chair masculine and why is book feminine, like all this seemingly arbitrary things. But the reason I bring that up is because even for inanimate objects where gender should not matter, like you're talking about professions where, it probably matters. But let's talk about things where you can scientifically study and design experiments where you can take objects that there is no logical reason why one should be masculine or feminine. And in fact, different languages put different grammatical genders on it. You can have an item that's masculine in one language and feminine in the other language. And it turns out that people think about those objects differently, describe them differently, represent them mentally differently, depending on the grammatical gender of those objects in their language. So if you take, there is a series of experiments, multiple experiments by a scientist at San Diego, at the University of California, San Diego, Lera Boroditsky. She basically looks at how speakers of languages that have different grammatical genders describe objects. And they find that if you take an item like a key, and if in your language key is feminine, you're going to describe it as tiny, intricate, golden, ornate, with this kind of adjectives. If key is masculine in your language, you're going to describe it as metal, jagged, rugged, hard, strong, however you with completely different adjectives. If you switch, so it's not specific to a language, you take the same two languages, but you switch things around and you take something like a bridge, and in the language in which key was masculine, now bridge is feminine. Bridge is described as long, slender, beautiful, romantic, however, and then you take the language in which key was feminine, now bridge is masculine, and the bridge is described suddenly in very different ways. This experiment was done with German speakers and Spanish speakers. So even such small things, just changing the grammatical gender changes how we represent those objects, how we think about them, how we describe them. And there are so many other experiments, how we remember them done along those lines. So if we see, how we think about a pen or pencil being influenced by grammatical gender, it's not surprising that how we think about people is also very much influenced by their gender in powerful ways. And I see it in everyday life and in everyday meetings. There are so many experiments showing how resumes are being evaluated differently when everything is the same. You just change the name to masculine versus feminine. Salary offers, so many things. And unfortunately, talking about this now is becoming taboo because we are seeing such a change in political climate that what can I say?
Hard these
Sometimes
days.
if you're looking at the news nowadays and then you watch The Handmaid's Tale, you don't know which one is what, which one's the reality and which one is fiction, dystopian fiction.
This is also a message in your book with choosing to study bilinguals as well. So you choose to say, just like we choose to say, women are important to study, to talk about, also to speak up. The same with bilinguals. You write that the gap in research on bilinguals has been so huge for years, and only now we realize we need to fill it. I feel that your books also gives some justice for the areas which are not really talked about.
As I was saying before, I think that if we don't do that, we leave out such important things about humanity. So I'll give you one example where, to some extent, I feel like sometimes we don't even know what we don't know because we are not including the entire sort of human spectrum. So, for example, completely by accident, we stumbled on a discovery related to autoacoustic emissions in bilinguals and multilinguals. And for people who don't know what autoacoustic emissions are, emissions that your ears produce. So if you put a very sensitive microphone close to your ear, you can actually record sounds that your ear emits. Few people know that. We know that our ear processes incoming sounds, our brain processes incoming sounds, but it turns out that our ears also produce this autoacoustic emissions. And simply by including bilinguals and multilinguals in a research project, we discovered if this was a collaboration between an autoacoustic emissions lab and my bilinguals and multilingualism lab, that the autoacoustic emissions produced by the bilingual and multilingual ears differed in statistically significant way from the autoacoustic emissions produced by monolinguals. So up until then, nobody has actually considered bilinguals and multilingualism as a variable, as an independent variable to look at. And this eventually will give us more information about the function of autoacoustic emissions, the brain activity involved, as we try to understand these differences. And this is just one small example that we stumbled across by accident by including multilinguals in a study. Think about how many other questions and answers, how many other answers we could get and questions we don't even know to ask unless we include brains who know many, many languages. And currently we think about bilinguals and multilingualism as noise, and we try to have this simplified model to keep things simple, to keep things as easy to control as possible in the lab, just one language, so we don't complicate it. But I actually would argue that bilinguals and multilinguals is no, it's not the noise. It is the signal that multilingual brains are the norm. And in my approach to this question in the book and in my research, I don't think about my multilingualism as just natural languages like English and Polish and other languages we speak, but about symbolic systems in general. So I go beyond natural languages to artificial languages like computer languages, to symbolic systems like music, like math, basically any symbolic system that allows us to use symbols to encode information, transmit it across space and time to be decoded at the other end, like we are doing now. Right now, I take my thoughts and ideas, I encode them in words, and through words, I transmit them across space to you, to your brain. Same thing is done with music, same thing is done with math. Artificial intelligence does that as well. So I believe very strongly that our brains are wired for multiple symbolic systems. You can speak, so like in our case, we know languages that have different alphabets, so different visual symbolic systems. Our brains are able to do that. They're able to do that elegantly, efficiently, very fast, and it changes our cognition, our creativity. We haven't even touched on that. I have an entire book, a chapter on creativity. So I think that multilingualism is the norm. And starting to approach the human condition and the human brain from this perspective of, the brain accommodating multiple symbolic systems, is incredibly important, especially as artificial intelligence is so quickly developing. So, yeah, that's where I stand on those issues.
Yeah, I also wanted to add, since you mentioned artificial intelligence, I hear some people saying that we don't really need to learn languages because AI will translate everything. And your book is really amazing in enumerating so many examples on why we should study languages, if not for communication, obviously the first thing that comes to our mind, but also for our brains, for our perception of the different cultures of different people. But I wanted to ask you, do you think that the AI may make learning languages easier, harder, or maybe a different way will be more approachable or less approachable?
If we're talking about learning languages, I do think that AI can help learn another language. You can use it to your benefit as you try to learn another language, as you try to attain fluency and move in that direction. And there are indeed many benefits to using this online translation tools. It makes many tasks easier. It makes travel easier to communicate, especially if you can translate things online. There are many benefits, especially in the short term. With using this these tools, including the ability to record and preserve languages that are disappearing. So there are more than 7,000 languages spoken in the world today, and they're several languages a year are disappearing. They're constantly being lost. So using AI to preserve those languages in a quote-unquote language museum is a good thing to do. And using AI to help translate text, translate speech, can be very helpful and has a lot of advantages. At the same time, the long term and even the intermediate sort of term issues that come out of that are less clear. So yes, we can use AI for things that are of low critical importance, but when you are talking about life and death kind of decision, you still want a competent human brain there. Because at this point, AI can still make mistakes and it can't read the room. It can't always know the cultural connotation, the political, there are all these nuances that can come into play when you are when you are negotiating serious political, economic issues. So I don't think that any of our leaders will be using AI to interpret on the political stage anytime soon. And they should not, because there are a lot of risks that could come from that. And no major life decisions like surgery or other, you know, life decisions should be made based on, at least at this point in time, on AI generated translations. It's a good starting point, but you still want a competent human brain to go through that. But long term, I think that AI can pose serious challenges to linguistic diversity. And to what I mean by that is, I think that it will accelerate the death and loss of languages around the world, languages that don't have as many speakers and are not spoken as widely and don't have as large of a digital footprint will disappear at a faster rate than they do now. And that eventually only a small set of major languages will dominate. We already see that happening, and it has been happening, of course, historically, but now it's happening at a much faster and much stronger pace. And if we are not worried about that and thinking, well, so what? There is no disadvantage to that. I'm not quite sure that that's true. And as you know, I have several chapters in the book that talk about how people who speak different languages think differently. They see the world differently. They make different decisions, logical decisions, different creativity processes, perception, just multiple aspects of cognition are changed by the languages we speak. So as we lose languages, we also lose some of the diversity of thought. And if we move in a direction where everyone is starting to think in a more uniform manner, all of us, I can see some downsides to that, especially as AI becomes stronger and better at making decisions and more powerful. I'm not sure that as artificial intelligence gets better, that it's a good move for human intelligence to, you know, lose some of it. It's this diversity of perspectives. We can achieve some of those goals in other ways, but language, again, is such a powerful shaper of thought that it remains to be seen to what extent the advantages and disadvantages will, you know, balance each other. And when it comes to AI, I think there is a lot of debate right now about the risks, the benefits. Everyone is approaching it from their own perspective. If you are working in the defense sector, You have your own perspective. If you're a computer scientist, you have your own perspective. If you're a cognitive scientist, you have your own perspective. My perspective comes from psycholinguistics, from multilingualism. So that's my angle on it. Everyone is approaching it from their own perspective. And so we live in interesting times for sure. And I'm glad that we are bringing multilingualism and bilingualism into the fold of the conversation. We may not agree, and it may not hold the same, we're still trying to understand many things about multilingualism because it's so new, but it is important that it is considered, and it participates in the next chapter of humanity's advancement. There is this, fiction and reality often go hand in hand, and there is this movie called Arrival that brings in this linguist who is able to build communication with another species through understanding how language works. And in this particular language, you could travel through time. Once you learn that language, you could time travel. Now, we don't yet know of any language that allows us to time travel, but the ability to communicate across species, across planets, across cultures, across humans is so important. And we see that in our everyday. So I tend to approach things from a more logical, reasonable perspective. So I tend to think about, if A, then B, and how things work in a scientific, logical world. But human relationships, unfortunately, don't always follow logic and reason. And I see that all the time in relationships between people, within families sometimes, within human relationships are complicated. And I don't think we fully consider the differences that are due to language, where we think we are saying the same thing, but we are not. Because when I use a word or when I say something, what I mean with that can be completely different than what you hear because of how your brain interprets language. And especially true in people who have different experiences, cultural experiences. In a sense, we are all kind of multilingual, even if you use different dialects, different cultures. How you speak to your grandmother is different than how you speak with your boss. This registers differ, and your brains are constantly having to figure out the best way to communicate, to use this linguistic system we have. So I'm glad we are finally understanding this and giving it attention.
So you mentioned something really important. The first thing today is actually the International Mother Language Day, the day that we're recording this. So it's amazing that you mentioned the importance of maintaining the languages and the cultures that they work at. And in Poland as well, there is a huge debate that the listeners will probably be interested about. So speaking a dialect, speaking a different register, is it good? Is it bad? Should we not teach children the dialects? Should the children only learn big languages like English and Polish? Is it also beneficial to learn like smaller languages, regional languages, dialects from the point of view of bilingualism? Is it still bilingualism if we know a regional dialect?
It's a really good question. And because I tend to stay close to data and not speculate, I will say that there is even less research on dialects and bidialectalism than there is on bilingualism and multilingualism. So bilingualism and multilingualism is a relatively new field that has come into itself in the last few decades. Research on dialects is even more scarce. So we really don't know. I can't quite answer that. We don't know if the consequences of bidialectalism and multidialectalism are the same as the consequences of bilingualism and multilingualism, but because language exists on this continuum, and it's sometimes hard to figure out where's the difference between a dialect and a language. Because if you take Romance languages like Spanish, Italian, French, what is Portuguese and Romanian, they can be much more similar to each other than maybe even Cantonese and Mandarin, and some Westerners consider Cantonese and Mandarin Chinese the same language or dialect of the same language, but then the five Romance languages are seen very differently. So it's hard to know where you draw the distinction between dialect versus language. And a famous definition in linguistics is to say that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. So a linguistic variety, the military that stands behind it, a lot of it comes with sociopolitics and things change and what's considered a language or a dialect. Like coming being having been born in Moldova, I had experienced that firsthand because during the Soviet years, the Russian policy was that Moldovan is a different language from Romanian. And of course, any linguist will tell you that Moldovan is a dialect of Romanian, same language, same dialect. It's the same language, but it's so politicized, and there were reasons why that was happening in terms of influencing cultural identity and politics. So the question is so broad, and I know we have to wrap things up. We could spend a whole hour just talking about that. But to answer your question, should we learn other languages, smaller languages? The only person who can answer that for you is you and your family, because what matters, that decision will differ depending on what your needs are. Do you want to stay connected to your grandparents? Are you building a relationship with someone who speaks that language? In close interpersonal romantically, we haven't even talked, we haven't even talked on that, but your ability to feel emotions can differ depending on the language you speak. And in the United States, being able to pass across generations the languages and the cultures of some of the indigenous populations, where many of those languages have been lost and continue to be lost, and now schools are trying to revitalize that. Those decisions, it's not for me or for any outside force to say what language one should speak at home, because and for parents too, it's a very personal decision what language to teach to your child, and you take into account multiple variables. But I will say that if as a parent you try to decide whether to raise your child monolingual or bilingual, don't fall prey to misinformation that raising bilingual children with two languages will confuse them or will lead to communication disorders, because there is no evidence for that. It is true that sometimes children who grow up with two or more languages can be what's known as late talkers. There can be some delays early on in development because they're building two systems at the same time or interconnected systems, so it can take a little longer. But eventually, they will attain both languages. They will attain them to fluency. And by the time they are in their teen years, they'll be able to fluently operate with two languages and draw all the benefits and advantages of knowing two or more languages. And there is no evidence that growing up with two languages increases incidence of speech disorders, autism, or any other communicative disorders. So you can become like all of that is just not true.
So definitely, if someone is interested in more details in your book, there's more details about what are the benefits of starting early of raising bilingual children. And I wanted to ask you as some of the final question, maybe not the last one if we still have some follow-up, but finishing this amazing interview, if someone is still hesitant, should I start learning a new language? I'm too old, or I don't have time. How would you persuade the person? In what arguments would speak up from the scientific and bilingual point of view that you would say are the most prominent things that someone should consider here? So, what are the benefits basically of learning?
Again, it's up to the individual to decide what I want to
But
learn.
like for your brain, I mean, from your scientific perspective, because obviously this decision is up to your moment in life and things like this. But
Yeah.
for your brain, for your cognition, what are the most prominent benefits here?
You can start to see benefits at, if you learn another language at any age, including later in life, you will reap those benefits. And we talked about some of them earlier. The reason I'm hesitant to say, yes, you should learn another language is because people will naturally stick with whatever they enjoy doing. And whatever, if you force someone to do something they don't enjoy, it's not going to work. So it has to be a very personal decision. Some people love languages, or they love travel, or they, enjoy communicating with people. And for those people, learning another language will have those benefits. Just like some people love, going to the gym and working out and exercising. And to other people, and to someone else, telling them, well, now you have to learn another language, it's yet one more thing to make them feel, guilty or bad about, and be like, beating themselves up because, oh, I should have done that and I didn't do that today. So I think, in the way I approach things in life to the extent possible, especially now, later in life, is to say, follow your bliss. And if you prefer to exercise, you exercise. If you prefer to learn how to play a musical instrument, you learn how to play a musical instrument. If learning another language is something you're considering, then I think you should go for it at any age because you will see those benefits to your brain at any age. And it just gives your brain a workout, an exercise, something new to learn. And there are so many ways to do this now. It's so much easier to learn another language than it used to be. And what it can do for you, it can also open up your world to more social interactions, open you up to travel more, to making travel more enjoyable because you are able to practice your newly learned skills. You can also trade language lessons with another person. So many older adults are often isolated and lonely and sometimes suffer from depression. And this can be a way to connect with another person who wants to learn your language, even if it's online. Maybe you are in Poland and you want to learn English and or another language, and there is a person in the United States who has a Polish background and wants to learn some Polish, and you can trade those language lessons. My brother, for example, was doing a certificate program in Sweden and found someone to trade Swedish and English lessons. So the woman he was trading lessons with wanted to learn English and he wanted to learn Swedish. And so it started with language lessons, and lo and behold, now that woman has been my sister-in-law for many years. So learning another language can have those social and interpersonal benefits. And it can be also an easy and enjoyable thing to do. So you can start easy just by listening to music in that language, or watching a movie in that language with subtitles in your native language, or the other way around, watching it in that language and with, subtitles, or so watching it in your native language and subtitles in that language. There are so many ways to learn another language. If you find what you like and what you enjoy, some people like the apps. Because it's sort of fun and they've been gamified. Others like to watch YouTube videos. And I see this, in my own family. People gravitate towards different things. Some people like learning alone. Some people like learning with another person. Some people like learning in groups. Some people like to just immerse themselves in another country and culture and language. In Europe, it's so much easier because you drive for a couple of hours and you're in another language and culture already. So if this is something that you think you'll enjoy, then you should go for it no matter what age you are. You can learn another language to fluency at any age, and you can reap benefits. Your brain can benefit at any age. Think of it as exercise for your brain.
Oh, that's a beautiful message. Also, not to be pressured. I also didn't mean to pressure anyone, just to enumerate what are the positive things that you can gain from this. But obviously, learning any skill or doing anything that you enjoy is the most important here. Okay, so for the last words, would you like to send a message about your book, or maybe tell who would be interested in reading such a book?
This book will help everyone else in the lives of this language nerds understand what it is we do and why we do it. So, to many linguists, a lot of the things that I talk about in the book It's already very known. They'll still find new interesting things because I do draw on what was cutting edge science and coming straight from the lab. Like some of the experiments are right out of the labs of my colleagues and around the world in my lab too. So they'll still find new useful information. But I think it will help people in their life who maybe are not so passionate about linguistics and language understand why we are passionate. In fact, I have colleagues who said, for the like people who've worked in the field for decades who said, okay, for the first time, my mother can finally understand what I do. Or for the first time, my significant other can finally understand what I do and why. So I think it's hard to find this balance between making it accessible to a broad audience, which I think it is. It's for anyone. You don't have to be a linguist. All the terms I explained in very accessible ways. If you are, a person, if you are a driver, if you have any field of work, the service industry, you will still understand, because I do go into science but make it accessible. So you'll understand most of it. But I still think that people who work in this field professionally will enjoy it because it just makes it really relevant to everyday life. So who should read it? I think anyone who either I think it, people will find it interesting if they either know two or more languages, or they would like to know two or more languages, or they have a relationship with someone who knows two or more languages. Even if you're monolingual and you don't want to learn another language, but you are in a relationship with someone who speaks another language, or is multilingual themselves, you will enjoy. I think this book will be a good fit for you and a good match for you.
Dzięki wielkie za wysłuchanie tej rozmowy. Jeśli temat wielojęzyczności Was zainteresował i chcecie wiedzieć więcej na temat tego, w jaki sposób języki działają w naszych mózgach, na temat tego, jak wpływają na nasze myślenie, na nasze decyzje, na nasze postrzeganie, to koniecznie zajrzyjcie do książki Potęga Języka, która ukazała się właśnie w wydawnictwie Uniwersytetu Jagiellońskiego. Bo to, o czym dziś rozmawiałyśmy, to jest może jakieś 5% tego, co znajdziecie w książce. Także bardzo polecam, jest to fajna książka zarówno dla osób, które dopiero zaczynają interesować się tematem języka, ale też dla tych, które już trochę wiedzą więcej i chcą sobie trochę tej wiedzy usystematyzować. Jeśli chcecie wrócić do tej rozmowy w formie pisanej, to znajdziecie ją przetłumaczoną na język polski na naszej stronie o-języku.pl. A jeśli interesują Was rzeczy językowe, językoznawcze, to koniecznie obserwujcie nas na social mediach Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Tam wrzucamy różne ciekawe materiały na tematy nie tylko związane z wielojęzycznością, ale też ogółem z językoznawstwem i różnymi językami. Dzięki wielkie, mam nadzieję, że Wam się podobało i do usłyszenia następnym razem.